Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Bert Weisbord, and I'm here to talk with David Field about my novel, Inside Passage. We'll be discussing the book, then talking about what buyers are looking for when they option a novel for motion pictures or television. I've produced feature films, including Ghost Stories, starring Fred Astaire, and Raggedy Man, starring Sissy Spacek. My first novel, Inside Passage, was published in January of this year. David is uniquely qualified to talk about writing and acquiring novels for televisions and movies. At ABC, he was one of three people responsible for the movie of the week. That's 52 movies a year. He was a production executive at 20th Century Fox, head of West Coast production at United Artists, and executive VP of worldwide production at Fox. He went on to write numerous screenplays, including writing and producing Amazing Grace and Chuck. Hello, David.
Hello, Bert.
It's nice to have you. I'd like to begin by asking you what you thought, just in general, about my novel, Inside Passage.
I thought it was fabulous, Bert, and having known you a long time, I never knew you as a writer. I was quite taken with not only the story, but the craft and the wisdom and the entertainment value. I'm quite taken with the book. I've now bought two copies and given them to other people. It's a great read, and I want you to keep writing.
Let's talk a little bit about the characters, because I think that's what I spent the most time on. How did you feel about Abe and Corey?
Oh, Abe and Corey are brilliant. I mean, I love the slow way you reveal them, their strengths, their weaknesses, their way they overcome their weaknesses. I love the entire backstory of their lives and how they combat their own fears and adversity. They're great stories as individuals, and it's a fabulous love story. I mean, it's just they're fantastic characters.
I love Abe's
kind of, what should I say, his modesty. I like him.
Yeah, that's. What about Nick and Jesse? And let me just say that Jesse is Abe's mother, and Nick is the antagonist. He's the one that framed Corey Logan.
I think Nick is a much more complex character than one sometimes expects in an antagonist. I like his backstory and the way it's slowly revealed about his childhood, the long con. I like what I learn about his time in the police for the South. I think it's extremely well done as you show him pursuing the relationship with Jesse and how he is a truly scary gigolo, and the psychic pain of that to him, that he is so cut off from human feeling, that it's all transactional, that it's all. I mean, his isolation is beautifully portrayed. She's fascinating. I think of Jesse actually in relation to Abe. She really informs Abe for me in a lovely way. And her blind spot is something that Nick takes every advantage of.
Do you find that relationship believable, Nick and Jesse?
I do find it believable. I find it believable really because of Nick. I think it's not within the scope of the book to tell me how Jesse became the way she is. You do that with Carrie, you do that with Abe, you do that with Nick. I don't know how Jesse became the way she did, but I believe that relationship because I think she is well drawn without taking me deeply into her past. Your voice of the various characters is some writers, when they write, everybody ends up sounding more or less the same. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yours don't. So Jesse, even though I don't know her backstory, I can assume I might know it in a generic way. Her voice is quite precise. Her attitude is quite well drawn. But the reason I really believe in the relationship is because I can see so deeply into Nick, because you let me see in the most intimate moments, the wires that run him, the damage that runs him, the isolation that is his experience. So I believe it for that.
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in is things not being what they seem to be. And Abe and Corey seem to be a very unlikely couple, and, you know, they simply, they're
not... I
can
understand why you like things not being what they seem to be, since you aren't what you seem to be, Bert.
I thought
you were a movie producer, and now you're a writer. I thought you were a financial guy, and you're all these things, and you're a wonderful writer, so, yeah, I get it.
Well, David, I just realized, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say how long ago this was, but when you were at United Artists and we worked on the project A New Wife that Freddie Raphael had written.
Yep.
And that is also about a very unlikely couple and things not being what they seem to be.
If you remember that.
I just flashed on that, yeah.
I know.
Let's talk for a second about Billy and Morgan. That's Corey's son and his girlfriend.
Again, that's a lovely... I mean, Morgan is kind of like... I love Billy thrown on his own. I love the way, again, you let me get to know your characters gradually. So I see Billy, and then little by little, as you kind of titrate through the book, a little more information, I get to know what happened to him when Corey went away, how he survived, his skill set, and he's looking for a home. He's looking for a safe place, and how he passes in the world of these privileged, entitled children, adolescents. And she surprises me because she rises to the occasion. You think that, okay, well, she's going to, when she finds out who he really is. But again, you know, she's a more interesting and layered character than that. So at every level, I'm loving all your characters, man, and the way they relate to each other, and the plot is, you know, I probably, as a writer, if I err more toward character than plot. My weakness is plot, but you do both, and that's I tip my hat to you. I wish I could. I don't do that as well as you do.
Well, thank you.
See, I made you cough there, huh?
Yeah.
Can you take a compliment? It's a genuine compliment, man. I'm serious. You do it. You do them both beautifully.
Thank you. I think that part of how I was able to do that is how tightly wound this book is. I mean, if you think about it, there's three interwoven love stories. Abe and Corey, Nick and Jesse, Billy and Morgan. And it's two mothers and their sons. And I don't really draw attention to that, but that adds a kind of resonance to it.
At what point in the writing of this did you realize what you just said?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, one day it just dawned on me that was at the sort of spine of the book. And, you know, you
did
have the one...
If somebody asked you what the theme of this book was, do you have an answer for that?
You know, I think it's about people and relationships, you know, authentic, true relationships not being what they seem to be. I mean, Nick and Jesse seem to be the perfect couple. You know, very successful. He's running for state attorney general. She's his mover and shaker in National Democratic Party politics, and both very attractive.
Well, they are the perfect couple if there was no unconscious in the human psyche.
Right.
Because their ambitions are beautifully matched.
And
but
they do well together, at least on the surface.
Of course they do. And he's, as a good, you know, well-trained gigolo, he's good at that part, at physical intimacy, too. However, unbeknownst to Jesse, the guy's a walking keg of nitroglycerin.
Absolutely.
Abe, by contrast, looks like an extremely passive man who is hidden behind... Right, who is hidden behind the role of, I'll listen to your problems on a 45-minute hour.
I mean, he sideswipes parked cars. He's always preoccupied. He, you know, the first time Corey meets him, he inadvertently sets a fire in his office with the match from his pipe, which he shouldn't be smoking in the first place because there's a smoking ordinance in Seattle. And, you know, at the same time, he can negotiate his inner life and that of others in a way that's uncannily able. And he has courage. He can.
But one of the things that you really do beautifully is he doesn't initially know if he has courage. He gets to discover that he has courage.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I also think that he knows that you have to face your anxieties, and that he deeply believes in his ability to do that, although he's never been called to do it in quite this way.
Well, if you and I were working on making a movie out of this one and we were talking to the actor playing Abe, I would say, unless you stop me, that your life was really on hold until Corey shows up.
Yes.
You were really treading water until Corey showed up. You were waiting for a reason, for something to ignite you. You live in the city with your powerful mother. You have the relationship that you cerebrally, that you conceptually can define beautifully, but you haven't really transcended it. You haven't really found the thing that's worth showing up for full tilt boogie until Corey Logan shows up. And then you find out who the fuck you are. And you do.
I think that's very well put. And I think that, you know, there's a line when he says that, you know, at his best, he's the bull in the china shop, you know, thinking of the unexpected thing. And
right.
he comes to do that in this book.
Is Einstein a particular hero of yours?
No.
Well,
why do you?
Well, because Abe has a little bit of the Einstein thing going for him. There was a story at Princeton about if you ran into Albert on Prospect Street around lunchtime and you invited him to lunch, he would be very gracious and say, "That's so kind of you. If I'm walking away from my home, I apparently have already had lunch, but if I'm walking toward my home, I accept."
That's a good
so Abe has a little bit of that.
Yeah, when he's not stepping in a pothole while he's talking to you.
Right.
But let's go back to Billy and Morgan, because, you know, they're not as important as the other two relationships, but it's a story of first love. And I mean, to oversimplify, Nick and Jesse is a sort of false relationship that's rotten at the core. Abe and Corey is an authentic relationship
I would rephrase that slightly, Bert. I would say that Abe and Corey are a story of first love too.
Yes, but at a different level.
A different age, sure.
Yeah, but I mean, there are people who are, where I was going with that is people who are learning to meet their real needs as opposed to their perceived needs or other people's idea of what their needs are. I mean, people who
as you rendered Nick and Jesse, they are people who never learned at all the virtue or the possibility of authenticity.
Right.
Neither one of them.
And Billy and Morgan is something that's much more intuitive, much more really lovely people feeling something deeply for each other that they are just beginning to understand. Very tentative.
Yeah.
And you make an important point when we have discussed this before. I mean, Billy is hiding who he is. I mean, Billy has just been in foster care, and just for people who haven't read the book, he's a soccer player, and he meets these private school kids because he's on a select soccer team. And Morgan goes to a private school in Seattle, and they fall in love. And he has to hide the fact that he is in foster care, frequently sleeps under the freeway, and he's dealing drugs as a way of supporting himself, and he has a secret life.
He's also dealing drugs as a way to render himself valuable to these entitled kids.
That's right. And they idealize his street knowledge. I mean, they think it's very cool that he knows his way around the Ave and, you know, on Broadway and so on and so forth.
Well, you know, you actually have a mirror for a young... He could, without Morgan, without his wonderful mother, without Abe, without his own character, he could go the way of Nick.
Yes.
He could become a man who spends his entire life dissembling because the overriding presumption of his life is that nobody would want to know who the fuck I really am. Nobody, ever. And he manages to escape that. And so, you know, one of the things that's odd for me is I actually end up having, which I like a lot, compassion for Nick.
Yes, I hope so.
Yeah, no, I do. And you wouldn't think you'd have compassion for a guy who likes to put an ice pick through people's lower jaw.
Yeah, he's really a bad guy, but you have to feel for where he's come from. And, you know, Nick is sort of these paralyzing anxiety attacks that he had as a young man are very frightening.
Yeah. So I don't know what it's like for you as a writer. I know for me as a writer, and like you, I came to writing late, although I started as a reporter. I only know how to become every character to the best of my ability. Do you do that?
Yes. I mean, I have, you know, there's degrees of it. When I'm at my best, I find the story taking unexpected turns because the characters are doing things that I didn't think of.
Right.
I'm inside their head in that kind of way.
It's like you as the writer get out of the way.
And see where it goes. And
well, you must have had a lot of that in this book, in my opinion, my experience of reading it. Because my experience, when the writers don't do what you just described, and they move their characters around like chess pieces on a board because they need them to do something to service a plot, as a reader, you can feel that.
Well, I think my favorite thing is, I mean, I describe this as a character-driven thriller, and it really is character-driven. The plot comes out of who the people are.
As it should. Yeah.
And that's what I love about this kind of material.
You're also pretty damn good on atmosphere, my friend.
Let's talk about the sense of place. Yeah, that's... I didn't mean to interrupt
you. Clearly love the whole Seattle Northwest San Juan Island locale, as I do too. I don't know it nearly as well as you, but I love how beautifully grounded it is in a place that clearly is known to you, and so I feel it through you. I mean, I remember reading a review somebody wrote about the book on some website, and they were complimenting you on your choice of restaurants in Seattle. Apparently, this is someone who travels on their stomach. So, but how fascinating that someone who travels on their stomach and doesn't read fiction found something so amazingly useful in this book of character and plot and thrills. So it's just, yeah, you did it great, man. You must have had a good time when you lived in the Northwest.
No, I did, and I'm glad that comes across, because I mean, there's something about Seattle is a cosmopolitan, in some ways very sophisticated city, sort of nestling right in Puget Sound and going up into the Inside Passage, which is really, you know, harsh and cold. I mean, people don't understand that Puget Sound is so cold. You fall off the ferry and you have hypothermia in 10 minutes, you know.
Wow.
I mean, it's very... And one of the things that I like about the book is that I feel like Corey can sort of navigate those waters. I mean, she's very good in the Inside Passage. She's very good in ways that Abe can't even swim, you know.
Right.
And
right.
So it's such a nice combination of her being so good in the wilderness and Abe being so good in his inner life, and bringing those sets of capacities together.
And they're both a wilderness.
Yeah. Let's shift gears here a little and talk about what you think about Inside Passage as a film versus doing it for television. Pros and cons.
Well, if I were running a studio, I would certainly have that discussion. I would want to do one of those two things. My guess is where I would come out is I would want to do it as a television show. I'd want to do it as a cable show. I'm sure you've seen The Killing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what some of the, as many people think, it's certainly not original with me, that some of the best writing right now in the entertainment world is in long-form television, because there is a chance to explore character over time, to deal with complexity. You know, Netflix just did it with remaking that BBC show, The House of Cards, which is really a 13, you know, the first season's 13 episodes of character. I mean, there is a plot, but the character is the cool thing about that. Your characters are people who are so engaging. I want to know where they go. I want to know what they do. You know, the difference between writing a script and a book, as you well know, in a script I can show you, as writer, the interior life of the characters. In a movie, unless I'm using narration, which is something you've got to be really judicious with, it's between people. I'm interested deeply, but in long-form television, you can kind of have an opportunity to do both, because a movie is such a Procrustean bed of, you know, whether it's an hour and a half or two and a half, it's a tough form. What you have to cut out, and I would hazard a guess that if you made this as a movie, it's probably a one-off, I would guess, although I don't know what your second novel is going to be. I wouldn't think this would be a movie franchise. It might be an excellent one-off movie, but I would much rather see you explore it in depth for 2, 3, 4, 5 years of long-form television.
Because I think sure.
What interests you?
I agree with you. I mean, I do think there is a standalone movie, and you should explain
there
to
is.
People what you mean by one-off.
Well, not the beginning of a franchise, not the Bourne Identity, not the...
Right. Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, just any... I mean, one of the things that movie studios clearly more and more and more is they're owned by multinationals and vertically integrated accounting firms, sorry for the bitterness in that comment. movies are really about branding now. There used to be 6 or 7 studios when you and I were doing that, Bert, and they made an average of, I think, something like close to 300 features a year. You're about 6 studios now, and they make about 45 movies a year. And
they're targeting a younger audience, too.
Talking to a younger audience, and the word branding didn't exist when we were, you know, branding's an interesting thing, isn't it? It seems to be the absolutely frank, unabashed, unashamed admission that form trumps content. I'm not happy when form trumps content.
Right.
But it seems to be the world I'm living in.
But in
long form television, you can do both. So as a standalone movie, you might get a really good director. You probably, if you don't write the script yourself, you could probably get, you know, one of the top tier writers to adapt this. And I suspect you get a very good movie out of it. But in this marketplace, I suspect it would be an independent film. Now, Silver Linings Playbook was an independent film. So you might end up having a triumph of an independent film, but that would be the end of it. And that would be a great end. I mean, who could complain? But I really think with these people, you have the opportunity to go wider and deeper and longer. That's all.
I agree with you. And, I going back to, like, The Wire, I mean, I just think the talent that has migrated to this long-form television is quite remarkable.
Part of that happened during the last big writer's strike, when so many writers were going hungry and writing spec scripts and realizing, as the studios made reality TV and other things, in the absence of writers. So a lot of the A-list writers have gone, both to survive, to long-form television. So the quality of writing is immeasurably better. On any, you know, there, I got, I don't know, there are probably 15 different shows that I watch in long-form television, and about two-thirds of them are on cable. Because I'm just fascinated to see my peers at work.
And the work is
and
very
I don't
good.
I don't have that in features that much. You know, I'm a member of the Academy, and I get to see all the. Barring the independent films, and not so many of those, is much better writing in television now.
No, I have this conflict. I too am a member of the Academy, and I feel obligated to watch all these films every year. And I would much rather be watching long-form television most of the time.
Yep, I know. We never imagined we'd be saying that, did we?
No.
I know.
And the things that so drew me to making movies in the 70s and just are more present in long-form television, it feels like there's been an evolution, and people are just doing innovative and imaginative things in long-form television that just are exciting to me. So
it's a really funny irony. When you graciously introduced me, when I worked at ABC in the 70s for Barry Diller and Michael Eisner, and we did make 52 movies a year, and they were on Tuesday and Wednesday nights, and they were 74 minutes in a 90-minute slot. And it was, as far as I know, the beginning of high-concept thinking.
Yeah,
if you can't describe it in TV Guide, you can't make it. And then Mr. Diller first, and then Mr. Eisner went to Paramount, and a lot of that high-concept thinking migrated with them. And then when distribution people in studios began to control production, that was interesting too, wasn't it? Because then the guys who have to sell stuff decide what's the easiest thing for them to sell. Well, the easiest thing to sell, as anybody who's ever been to the Cannes Film Festival knows from watching guys at the Carlton Hotel sell a poster with no script, is a concept. And now the wheel has turned sufficiently that high concept has taken over movies to a large extent, certainly in the major studios, and in-depth things that you can't quite describe in a TV Guide logline are showing up on long-form television.
And they're showing up in a way that's more leisurely. You have more time to do it. You have a different kind of grammar. I mean, you can interweave very complicated storylines over quite a long period of time in a way that the shorter movie form just doesn't allow, even at its best.
Right. And you talk about the three love stories in Inside Passage. And any one of those love stories would be worth, well, obviously Aben Khoury is the core, but those other two love stories would be worth any couple of 2-3 hour-long segments where they could take the forefront of an hour.
Absolutely.
And we'd love to see that, but you can't do that in a feature.
Well, Inside Passage is the first in a trilogy, and I very much look forward to talking with you about the next book. I would like people to be able to go to my website, which is www.burtweissboard.com, and you can learn more about all three books there. And David, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed talking with you. It's bringing back lots of very good memories, and your support and your insightfulness means a lot to me. So thank you very much,
well,
David.
It's a two-way street, Bert. Thank you ever so much. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.